I do not live in an artificial world. I do not live in a religious world or a world of churchianity. I don't live in a world of doctrine. I don't live in a world of fantasy. I live in the real world. And real events in real places affect my family, affect me personally, and affect every single one of you. We don't pay attention generally as Americans to what is happening in Europe or the Middle East or the Australasian area, as it's sometimes called, the Far East, in Korea, between China and Russia. We get a little bit of a smattering, a kind of a smorgasbord of world news that the leftist liberal media decides we ought to have. They make decisions. Some of their decisions are a little bit obvious, I think, sometimes. For example, they have decided that the Americans should elect or at least choose McCain over George Bush because they feel that McCain will be easier for Gore to beat. So therefore, they're hyping McCain. Anyway, that is an opinion of an awful lot of people. And the leftist liberal media in this country just tells you about 0.1% of what is really happening in a world that you really ought to know. Most people, if you ask them, would say, well, what was all the hype about Y2K? I mean, my lights didn't go out. My pump at the gasoline station was still working. I got my paycheck on time. Nothing really happened. It was a little minor bump in the road. And so far, most people would think that is about exactly what it was, a minor bump in the road. Well, there are several websites, among them one which deals with nothing but Y2K glitches. And it's called Glitch Central. And if you look into it, there are literally hundreds of articles, many, many links, which absolutely prove that there are tens of thousands of Y2K computer glitches that are happening virtually daily all around the globe. Not the least of which may be the suspected computer maintenance programs on aircraft and major airlines, and which might help to explain or might not the rather untoward number of airlines crashes of recent date. Give you just a little bit of a smattering. I just checked off a very few of them, page after page. I can't begin to take time to read them all. Here they are, day by day. The underlining on each one of these pages means that if you click on it, as they say on your computer, it opens up a whole new page and a lot of links, and you get to read the entire article or several articles on the problem. February 8th, the Santa Fe Water Company was having Y2K glitches, and there were stacks of false disconnection notices. A fire struck an unmanned radar station, the second one that had happened. The Philadelphia education computer system was upside down. Hong Kong Stock Exchange was down due to Y2K difficulties. On the 7th, North Korea experienced the worst power outages it had ever had and blamed the United States for it. Virginia was seeking a cure for accounting woes, and a NASA system had not been working since mid-January. The Y2K bug visited the Hadley Water System. The software was not prepared. The Chicago Board Options Exchange computer was halted, and the trading could not go on. Yahoo, which is one of the major web sources, broke down. An updated airline event summary. There was another MD-80 that could not stay in the air. February 5th, University of New Mexico computer did not read the data correctly. Northeast Ohio School District had computer problems. On the 4th, 105-year-old woman was offered a kindergarten spot in a Norwegian daycare center. And there was a telephone snafu in central Montana. On the 3rd, the computer glitch may be the reason for widespread phone service outage in central Montana, and a faulty microchip had caused traffic signal problems in Great Bend. On the 2nd, Scotland Yard experienced major data-related errors, and Vauxhall, a major automobile dealer or actually manufacturer in England, reported 100% failure. On the 1st, a malfunctioning chip at a Casitas dam caused false evacuation chaos, and people were ousted out of their home because they thought the dam had broken, when it had not. In Minneapolis, a 911 dispatch system went down, and in Toronto, thousands of school board employees were not paid because their checks were not issued on time. On and on it goes. There are dozens of them, really hundreds of them here. I'll turn a few pages to give you just perhaps one last one that is a little more of a serious nature. That is that there was a Spanish nuclear reactor, two of them actually, having breakdowns as a result of Y2K failures, And there was a 20% rise in waterline breaks blamed on dry weather and, of course, the lack of computer maintenance that was maintained in that way. So these are just a few of the things. There are several sites like this, and there are thousands of different items coming in. He says this site is dedicated to posting substantiated Y2K glitch-related news from around the world and asks that you pass this on and that other people pass on the information so it's freely. You can print it or pass it on as you would like. And he said, we are updating this page hourly until things fizzle or the power might go down, and let it be known that we're making every possible effort to report news that is substantiated and that is accompanied by a substantiated URL. At the end of this one article that I downloaded and printed off, he gives figures about a glitch weight, and it shows a chart and how it is rising day by day, that there are more and more of them pouring in. What they're concerned about right now is that this is leap year, and the date at the end of this month might cause additional computer glitches. All right, it was not anywhere near the problem that we thought it could be or that it might be, which is why I'm glad that I took a very conservative approach in all of the things that I wrote about for a year and a half and said that we should not overreact, that people should not buy thousands of dollars worth of food and medicinal supplies and guns and stockpile all those things and hunker down in Montana somewhere, sandbagged in a cave, waiting for the world to come to an end. I said airplanes were not going to fall out of the sky, and they didn't as a result of Y2K. And I said the end of the world was not going to occur, and of course it didn't. And Jesus Christ was not going to come, and of course he didn't. But I did say there were possibilities of terrorist attacks. Well, all the governments pretty much in the West, of course, why would maybe the Cape Verde Islands worry about it? But the United States and Britain and most of the big developed countries did. And they alerted everyone from local, county, state, and national law enforcement agencies all the way to the National Guard. And consequently, because of arrests that were made up in Canada, where Canadians tried to cross the border, or they were not Canadians, they were actually Algerians, but from two places in Canada who had bomb-making materials, and because of the high alert, that was obviated. They said that there were policemen every 10 feet in Times Square, and so any terrorist who was going to attempt something either would have had to have been a suicide bomber, or he wouldn't have attempted it because of heightened security. And as I wrote, and we published it on the website, God says, Christ said in Matthew 24, be ye also ready, for you know not in what hour the Son of Man cometh. And because the law enforcement agencies were ready, and the financial industry was ready, and Wall Street was ready, and the really big companies like ICBM and General Motors and all of those were ready, after all, they'd spent more than $1 trillion getting ready, they had comparatively only minor problems. As I said previously, it would be the smaller businesses and the local and regional areas that would have problems, and that's exactly what has begun to happen. Well, enough of that. I'm going to actually give you a little bit of a potpourri of what is going on in the world right now, current trends and conditions. All of you know that Russia has had a new government and that Putin looks like a shoo-in to be elected as president, and that he is going an entirely different direction than did his predecessor, Boris Yeltsin. This is an article, The Bear Awakens, and it is about how Putin is a very aggressive individual with regard to foreign policy and has set himself and Moscow firmly on a collision course with Western interests. The article says, in a series of actions over the past few days, the new government of Vladimir Putin, or Putin if you prefer, Russia's acting president, the elections are coming up in March, and they say that he's almost a shoo-in because he is so popular, has moved to bolster its military, befriend repressive regimes, including North Korea and China, and has put the West on notice that it will become a rival rather than a partner. Despite receiving a cautious welcome in the West, where Madeleine Albright, the U.S. Secretary of State, praised Mr. Putin this week for his open-mindedness, his actions seem to send a completely different signal. He is a former KGB agent who was expected to win next month's presidential elections virtually unopposed, and he is very aggressive. Igor Ivanov, his foreign minister, visited North Korea just the other day and signed a friendship pact with this repressive communist regime, Kim Jong II, who is a pariah in the entirety of the international community, and of course has been threatening war against South Korea and has been positioning missiles. Then the foreign minister, Igor Ivanov, was to follow up by visiting Japan, where Russia has indicated it will not honor a commitment made by Yeltsin to resolve the dispute over the Kur Isles. That was territory seized by Stalin when they entered in about 2 or 3 days before the end of World War II and grabbed the Kamchatka Peninsula and the Kur Isle Islands and have kept them ever since. So they declared war on Japan after we had bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and just moments before the Missouri entered Tokyo Bay and the documents of surrender were signed. You can leave it to Russia to do that because they wanted to grab that territory while Japan was on its knees. They seized it at the end of the Second World War. Russia is further making its presence felt in the region with delivery expected this month of another guided missile destroyer to China. There were a couple I told you about that had come from Murmansk all the way down and through the Suez Canal and were delivered into Chinese ports for several months. Chinese and Russian sailors have been training together, and these are the largest ships now in the fledgling Chinese Navy, which is beginning to grow, and they are guided missile destroyers that have the capability of launching ship-to-ship missiles, and which could carry nuclear weapons and could take out U.S. carrier battle groups. The sudden activity in the Far East has been matched by other initiatives closer to Moscow. The Kremlin has just assigned the sole right to extract and exploit Chechnya's oil and gas reserves to Rosneft, which is Russia's last state-owned oil giant. All the others have been privatized. Interesting that the government rewarded the fruits of their victory over this protracted guerrilla war and crushing the Chechens and virtually destroying Grozny, and then awarded the state-owned major oil producer all of the oil that is there, and it's quite a good bit of it. Last week, the Presidential Security Council passed a new Russian military doctrine, which relaxes the rules of engagement of Moscow's nuclear forces. From next month, when the doctrine comes into effect, the Russian head of state will be allowed to use, listen to this, atomic weapons in conflicts that do not necessarily threaten Russia's territory or security, meaning any foreign region anywhere, that they could use nuclear weapons. Now, they had, on paper at least, eschewed that previously, but they've now changed it to where there's a brand new doctrine that has been handed down from the government to the Soviet military. The change in policy is regarded as an important shift when coupled with other moves on the military front. Recently, Russia successfully test-fired the Topol-M ballistic missile that I wrote about in the last issue of 21st Century Watch. It is a gigantic ICBM that is mounted on a huge, big truck with about 20-some wheels. It is an all-terrain, mobile unit that can be camouflaged and moved all around the country, so it is not in a hardened silo. It's a new generation intercontinental weapon that was launched from the Pletsk site in northern Russia and hit the Kamchatka Peninsula 5,000 miles away, right on target. Mr. Putin also promised recently to double military expenditure after his campaign in Chechnya. So they have brutally repressed a potential breakaway republic because they want to hang on to all the territory that they can and because of the oil and other resources there. And now they're going to heighten, double that is, their military expenditure. Well, it's interesting. There was a book many years ago. It was called Point of View, and it was quite an educational piece because most of the time, most people do not look at the point of view of someone else, especially if it is someone with whom they disagree. But if you were a Russian and you had endured what the Russian people did in World War II, where over 30 million of their people perished, and where more than half of their territory was occupied by the Wehrmacht, and where there was the burnt or the scorched earth policy of the Nazis when they retreated, of burning everything right down to the barns and corrals of the peasants. And if you were looking at the West with jaundiced eye, having endured 40-some years, nearly 50 years of a Cold War, and had been taught by your media, which was state-controlled, that the West is out to rule the world, Would there be anything that has happened in the last several years, you think, or anything that has happened at all with the formation of certain pacts and treaties and certain alliances, which would indicate to a Russian peasant lady and her children living in some town somewhere in Western Russia that the United States seeks to dominate the world? What about the expansion of NATO toward the east? NATO is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. It was put together on a cruiser off Halifax, Nova Scotia, in the early parts of World War II, wherein Churchill and Roosevelt decided that they would form the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, where we would, in the North Atlantic region, come to each other's aid if we were attacked. From that time on, NATO, North Atlantic Treaty Organization, has grown exponentially, marched right across Europe into Eastern Europe, right on the doorstep of the Soviet Union. How would you feel if you were a Russian citizen looking at the march? Look what happened in Cuba at the Kennedy-Khrushchev missile standoff. Look what Maurer is warning about right now in the Panama Canal with Hutchison Whampoa, the huge firm that has really manage a lot of ports around the world, including Hong Kong, and where their principals have contacts high in the Chinese army, and they are now in possession of the military bases, including the deep water ports, two of them, and a couple of three Air Force bases and one major army base, which was the only place in the world where United States Armed Forces could train with regard to jungle warfare, because we have no other area in the tropics where they could do that. Well, they've all been abandoned and deserted now, and the Panamanians have taken over. But Hutchison Whampoa has the possibility of subletting any of these facilities, including all of those around the Panama Canal itself, to anyone it chooses. And there are direct links to the highest echelon Chinese army officials. And that is known. And Admiral Maurer was a former Joint Chiefs of Staff chairman, so he knows exactly what he's talking about. If we were to have seen the Soviet Union succeed in remaining in their, like, hegemony, as it's called, or influencing and having their missiles parked in Cuba, and then maybe advance through Mexico, how would you, as the average American, feel about that? Would you feel threatened? Well, of course. So look at it from the other person's point of view. They don't know any more about what happens in America and the way we feel, our day-to-day lives, the way we think, the way we react to international crises, than the average Russian peasant or the average American person knows about what's happening in Russia. They know virtually nothing at all. Most Americans are absolutely blissfully ignorant of world affairs, of world news, of what is happening in Europe and in the Middle East and in Russia and China and Korea, as I say, in India and Pakistan and everywhere else. They only get that little smorgasbord, the little hors d'oeuvres, the little bits and pieces of news that are fed to them by the three or four major news media over television. And most Americans get their news that way. The average family does not subscribe to news magazines. And those who do not subscribe to four, five, or six of them, but only one or two. The average family does not know much of what is going on, and most of the people in other countries don't either. Now, Russia and China, for many, many years during the Cold War, were at odds. The Chinese kept many divisions along their border, clear up the other side of Mongolia. And the Russians had to have garrisons all along the border with China because they didn't trust each other. Yeltsin went down there and began to open up a good deal of cooperation between Russia and China. I want to tell you now about how China, in its military, has actually written documents which say that China is preparing for war with the United States and says that it is inevitable. Now, think of the other fellow's point of view. If you were the leaders of the world's largest nation, with over a quarter of the population of the world, a nation that goes back for thousands of years, that was an advanced culture with a written language and art, the nation that invented the gun, the nation that invented gun power, and you had seen yourself attacked and over half of your territory occupied by what you would consider to be a lesser nation, Japan, during the early parts of World War II, beginning in 1924 with the Mukden Bridge incident. And you had seen, from that time, foreign devils, they're called gaijin in Japanese, come in and have enclaves, including the German enclaves, the British enclaves, the Portuguese enclaves, the Dutch enclaves, and the United States and Britain together in different pockets all around the periphery of your own nation, such as Hong Kong and so on. What would you think? How would you feel? When you know, and you know that you know, that the United States of America now claims to be the world's only superpower, that we have intervened rapidly and with decisive force in places like Panama and arrested its dictator leader, whether that's legal or not in international law has been debated over and over and over again. Went down there, the CIA was working in collusion with him prior to that time. He was actually buddy-buddy with the CIA and with past American presidents. But we went down, invaded the country, arrested him, and put him in jail. We did similar things in other parts of the world. Grenada comes to mind. And because it is an area where communism allegedly was threatening American students that were studying down there and was about to take over and establish a puppet government under President Reagan, we went down, invaded the island, absolutely did in the government, put in a different government that was favorable to the West. Look at Bosnia-Herzegovina and Americans in blue helmets under the aegis of the UN in a peacekeeping role. Kosovo comes to mind. Now, when Kosovo was being bombed, NATO bombers, mostly Americans, some British Tornadoes, were also bombing Yugoslavia back into the 1950s, as my daughter-in-law's mother and sister can tell you. Because to this day, there are only certain hours in Yugoslavia, in Belgrade and Novi Sad, when they can turn on the water or the lights. It's only half and half. There are other hours when they cannot. One of those bombs went right down the middle into the building that was leased and belonged to sovereign China, the Chinese embassy, and many people died instantly or were horribly mangled. The Chinese government does not believe to this day, nor do the average Chinese on the street, that that was an accident. They think it was a warning. They think it was the United States sending a message to China that you'd better beware of American power. Now, strategic writings by China's military and party leaders show that China is making plans for war, and this is according to a newly released document from the Pentagon. The Chinese strategists plan to use a combination of Marxist-Leninist doctrine and ancient Chinese tactics against the United States, which is being compared in Chinese military writings as a hegemon on a par with Nazi Germany. General Li Jun, described as one of China's most distinguished military authors, states that the United States engineered the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait as a strategic misdirection or deception. Other Chinese authors say that the United States is working covertly to dismember Western China, namely Tibet. The report is a public document, but the Pentagon is limiting its distribution, and according to it, the late Chinese leader Deng Xiaoping, whom my father met, set the current military strategy for dealing with the world's so-called only superpower in the slogan, quote, bide our time and build up our capabilities. A key debate among Chinese military and party writers is how rapidly the United States will decline. That's interesting. I can see the seeds of decline in the United States right now, but that's based upon Marxist ideas on capitalism, not my concept of dry rot from within and the most corrupt government in the history of the United States. Chinese plans discuss means of taking out U.S. aircraft carrier battle groups with their missiles and with submarines and other means. China now seeks to avoid head-on confrontation until around 2030. When the Chinese expect U.S. power to have declined significantly. However, a war between China and the United States could erupt, says the document, over Taiwan. Strategist Gao Hen wrote a U.S. defense of Taiwan would cause a major war of global and historic implications. But the report also said this, that China plans electronic attacks on our computer networks. The United States government is not subsidizing what they're now calling geeks or computer nerds. that is very gifted, very brilliant, very intelligent young high school and college age men to go to a college to do nothing except study how to become a computer hacker. But the Chinese government is doing that. They are subsidizing some of the brightest young men they can find by testing and sending them to a college where they're learning how to become computer hackers to enter into various systems all over the world. Now, when you think about the FBI currently seeking to find who it was that just about destroyed some of the four greatest huge big dot-com businesses like eBay and even CNN.com in their news, and like Amazon.com, one of the world's greatest booksellers, and just about put them out of business temporarily, they have narrowed their search down apparently now to Oregon and to California. But they say that doesn't mean it couldn't have come from someplace anywhere in the world, because it can come from any country anywhere. But they're narrowing down the search. Probably what the Congress needs to do is to consider whether or not a major sentence like 20 years to life or even a death penalty should not be the reward for someone who would literally bring down a major economy. There were hundreds of millions of dollars lost on the stock market, and the stock market took a big dip when that happened because of maybe only one or two people, maybe teenagers, who decided to hack in to these very vulnerable systems. Now, let's do a little bit of detective work here. Who else do you suppose would have an interest in causing a lot of these big companies to get very, very nervous about whether or not they had security, like the proverbial electronic firewall, so that people can't get into their computers? Well, what about the major companies who instantly found their stocks going up, who sell exactly that kind of protection and software in the computer industry? And I have it in my computer. I bought it. I've got some software that has actually been put into my major computer, which is supposed to protect me from anybody getting inside my computer that I don't want in there. Otherwise, people somewhere anywhere in the world could get in and read all my files. That's how vulnerable you are. It's like someone listening in on your telephone on the other line, except it's more complicated. So you have to think about that. Quote, Major General Jan Jungfeng, quote, "We can make the enemy's command centers not work by changing their data system. We can cause the enemy's headquarters to make incorrect judgments by sending disinformation." The average American knows nothing about any of this. I don't think that they're aware at all of the plans of other nations. They don't even think in those terms. Now, turning to another area of the world for a moment, you have heard about Georg Haider. I told you, I think, a week or two ago, and there's an article about that in the current number of 21st Century Watch. Well, here's some of the things that he said. In October 1990, a long time ago, he was addressing a World War II veterans meeting of SS officers. You see, Hitler's SS, the Sicherheitsdienst, whatever the other word was, I forget, but it was like a state police. They were the private palace guard for Adolf Hitler. They wore the two runes of the lightning, and they had the death's head, as you know. But also because he wanted them to infiltrate the army, because Hitler did not trust the old Prussian generals and didn't really trust the army, he assigned certain units that were coming out of the Hitlerjugend and, of course, were formed in the 1930s, 37, 8, and 9, when they were preparing for war, and made them into what is called the Waffen-SS, or the War-Making SS, or the Army SS. And they even had divisions like Panzer divisions of the Waffen-SS and fought on all the fronts during World War II. But they were an elite party mechanism. We've never had anything like that. It would be like saying that we have a Republican Guard in the Army or a Democratic Guard in the Army that is a part of a political party. We've never had that. There's complete separation of political parties and the armed services in the United States. It wasn't so then. That's who these men were, SS officers. Do you know what else they were assigned to do? They were the units who ran all the death camps. All the dozens of them, and there were dozens of them, not just the ones that you think of that you know three, four, five names. He said to those men in that celebration, "Our soldiers were not criminals. At most, they were victims." You know, you tell a big lie, and Hitler knew that, and if you tell it often enough, actually the bigger the lie and the more you repeat it, the more people tend to believe it. Like, there are people in the United States that believe that the U.S. government bombed the Murrah building up in Oklahoma City, bombed its own building. There are people who believe that, in spite of all the evidence, and it is, there's a plethora of evidence that McVeigh did it, along with Nicholson, or Nichols, and that they had this literature, the book by this guy, the Turner Diaries, that advocated the blasting of the FBI headquarters in Washington, D.C. All right, well, enough of that, but I'm saying that if you repeat a lie often enough, an awful lot of people believe that kind of thing. In June of the next year, he said in the Third Reich, they had an orderly employment policy. He was talking again about immigrants and about double-digit inflation and about the xenophobic anger on the part of young Germans and Austrians, especially in East Germany, at other people who are in there. But yet, if you were to look at the other side of that coin, it's an awful lot like a lot of minorities in the United States in the entry-level jobs. There are an awful lot of people here from Vietnam, from Korea, from all kinds of other countries, certainly from Cambodia. There are people here from Central and South America, from Mexico. They're coming in by the droves every single day. And they come into jobs that Americans won't take. Every one of our groundskeepers out on the golf course where I live are Chicanos. I speak to them all the time because I speak reasonable Spanish. Other people can't talk to them. They're documented, I think. But the point that I'm making is if you look at the entry-level jobs and you go around and look at anywhere from the Big Mac to the quick food places and all of that, they can't get busboys and waiters fast enough. And if you look at the turnover, they're in there for only a couple, 3 months, and the same faces are gone. They're youngsters who come in, and very quickly they're gone. They move on to something else. Well, the same thing is true over there. Those people who are there from Turkey and from Greece and from Vietnam and from African countries and all over are taking jobs that most self-respecting Austrians and Germans wouldn't take. But because the economy is sagging, and because unemployment is high, and because Kohl couldn't make good on his promise to absorb the Eastern Germans and to give them the same kind of a wonderful lifestyle that had been known for decades in West Germany, and they are still in terrible economic straits over there, they're very upset. Now, Haider made this statement in the provincial parliament of Carinthia, of whom he is governor today, and after the uproar that followed, he said, "I unequivocally made the point that this remark was not made to the meaning understood by you. If it reassures you, then I will take back the remark with regret." However, he was later forced to step down as governor, but he has been reassigned as governor following the elections last September. In 1995, during a parliamentary debate, he referred to, quote, "the punishment camps of National Socialism," end quote. And he implied that the inmates had been guilty of crimes. Incredible. In September of 1995, addressing again World War II veterans, including members of the Waffen-SS, quote, "there are still decent people of good character who also stick to their convictions despite the greatest opposition and have remained true to their convictions until today," end of quote. In December 1995, on a TV interview, quote, "the Waffen-SS was a part of the Wehrmacht, and hence it deserves all the honor and respect of the army in public life," end of quote. In November 1999, he admitted that he'd made some remarks about Nazism which were insensitive or open to misunderstanding, and for this, he said, he apologized. Interesting. One more thing about Haider here. This is a couple of excerpts out of a Washington Post article. "The striking gap between Austria and abroad in judging the Haider phenomenon reflects a profoundly different appreciation of his origins and his character. While foreign governments perceive Mr. Haider as a far-right demon beneath a shark-skin, smooth personality and media-savvy style, Austrians regard him as a populist firebrand who gives voice to their anxieties about being overwhelmed by immigrants and surrendering their national sovereignty to an ever-expanding EU. What have I said for 20 or 30 years about the eventual creation of a United States of Europe? I said clear back in the 50s and 60s that the eventual United States of Europe is not going to come about as a gradual, peaceful process of the nations in Europe gradually coming together in cooperation and forming a 10-nation coalition. I have said much more recently, over and over again, long prior to the Berlin Wall coming down in 1989 and subsequent to that on many occasions, and I have it in written documented form to prove it, that it will come not as a result of a gradual coalition at all, but as a result of a global economic collapse, as a result of another great world depression, as a result of collapsing economies in Europe, where incumbent governments will be blamed with a new poverty of the citizens, and where those people, where democracy is still an experiment, will turn very quickly and jump into the arms of a deliverer, a leader of some kind, and that neo-nationalism is going to occur everywhere. The attempt at globalism, which I'll talk about a little later on if I have time, is not going to succeed any more than it succeeded at the Tower of Babel when God came down to scatter the races at that time, because he said, this they begin to do, and now nothing will be withheld from them which they say to do. All right. Notice that it says that these people are really responding to him because of his continually harping about immigrants and surrendering their national sovereignty to an ever-expanding EU or European Union. Haider's appeal is that he says what many people think, said Andreas Kirchhofer, who is a political pollster. There is much latent skepticism in Austria toward immigrants and the European Union, and I fear this will grow in the years to come. Haider is well aware of this discontent, and he has proved more clever than other politicians in exploiting it. While the outside world considers him a pariah for his controversial endorsement of Nazi labor policies, his opposition to bringing Eastern states into the EU and his anti-immigrant diatribes, Mr. Haider has ridden the latest wave of criticism to whip up nationalist fervor on his behalf. All right. Neo-Nazism is rife in Eastern Germany and even in Belgium and even in France today, believe it or not. And eventually that is going to become a totalitarian state. That is, Germany and Austria and the other countries are going to join in with it, and it will be a new second time around, almost bizarre repetition of what happened prior to World War II, when Hitler took power at a time when there was a tremendous economic malaise inside Central Europe. Turning to the Middle East for a moment, did you know that for the last several days 30,000 Jews were in underground shelters in Kiryat Shmona, I believe it is, and other little towns along the Lebanese border? And did you know that almost a major war, because there were days and days of protracted Israeli IDF aircraft that were mounting strikes against targets in southern Lebanon, which drew criticism from France and many other countries in the EU, and of course has really put their newly elected Prime Minister Ehud Barak between the proverbial rock and a hard place, because he was just in Washington, where once again Clinton failed in his attempt to preside over peace process between Syria and Israel. Well, he goes back there. But no Israeli president could stand still for Russian Katyusha rockets being launched out of southern Lebanon Hezbollah cells against undefended citizens and Israeli farmers and men, women and children in little villages along the southern Lebanese border. So he had to approve of what the IDF did and let them do it. That has, of course, caused a lot of the right-wingers to applaud and hope that the peace process is going to be derailed. Now, all the time that he was over here only about a week ago in the United States and shaking hands with Clinton and not, of course, Assad, he would not deign to come, but he sent his foreign minister instead from Syria. The major government spokesman of Syria in a newspaper comes out and says that the Jews have been playing the Holocaust for all it is worth. They have greatly exaggerated it. Nowhere near that many Jews were put to death. And furthermore, they do it only to cause the knee-jerk reaction and the conscience-stricken West to fork over more foreign aid. And very shortly, even though King Hussein, prior to his death, signed peace documents and Jordan has been looked upon as a friend of Israel, a major newspaper in Amman, Jordan, echoed the very same sentiments and applauded the editorial in the Syrian newspaper, saying the Holocaust has been exaggerated by the Jews. None of these nations, not Syria, not Jordan, not Iraq, not Iran, not Egypt, not Saudi Arabia, not the Persian Gulf sheikdoms, not Algeria, none of them have ever abandoned, nor have any of their cells, the Hezbollah and the Black September and all the others that have been sponsored by Syrian and Iranian money, nor have any of the other guerrilla organizations abandoned their avowed intent to, quote, drive the Zionist entity into the sea, end quote. They want nothing short than the extermination of the Jews in the Middle East. That is their plan. That is their program. That's what the Palestinian Authority eventually hopes to achieve. Now, this year, the Palestinian Authority says it is going to announce statehood. It may do so by the month of June, at the latest by September. Nations which, of course, either are, again, like the United States, in a position of straddling a barbed wire fence and keeping an ear to the ground on both sides, which is an awkward position because of Arab oil, are going to leap in and recognize that state. And, of course, all the other Arab states will be very, very quick to come on board and do exactly that. That means that from the moment, and they've already cut the tape, you know, on the new airport in the Gaza Strip, on the moment that that recognition is given, then aircraft can begin flying back and forth in there from anywhere in any of the other Arab states in the Middle East or anywhere in the world, and they will have an open airport, an international airport in the PA, Palestinian Authority in Gaza, and Yasser Arafat and his ilk will now have a nation. And nations can form pacts and mutual defense treaties. And nations can do business in arms. They can appeal to any country on the earth. And, of course, the greatest arms exporter is who? Anybody know? The United States. And the second greatest arms exporter is Russia. Right. You have it. They deal in arms, and they sell them to anyone who is interested. Witness what Russia has done with the Chinese. And so very, very quickly, you could begin to see sophisticated weaponry being purchased by the PA, and you could also see some of that being given in terms of loan with non-interest-bearing amortization over a period of 50 years, so far as some of the really wealthy Persian sheikdoms are concerned, because they're not in the business of making money off of arms or transshipping arms that they get even from the United States, which could end up in the hands of the Palestinian Authority. Syria and Jordan then both chimed in on claiming the Jews exaggerated the Holocaust. And, of course, Syria wants all the Golan Heights back. And you remember when our First Lady had said when she was over there, after she hugged the wife of Jordan's king for having made the outrageous, or I should say Yasser Arafat's wife, for having made the most outrageous statement you ever heard about the Israelis actually causing the death of hapless civilians and women and children and so on. And she was very severely chided for that when she came back to this country. But while she was over there, knowing little, if anything, about world affairs and about foreign policy, she said, well, I think they ought to give up 13% of their land. So she created an incredible flap. Poor New York. I'm so glad I don't live in New York. I can't tell you how happy I am. Another factor you need to crank into your thinking here is United States' weakness and unpreparedness to perform the rapidly expanding tasks that are being given to an increasingly diminishing and inferior military. When we entered World War II, our army was 15th in the world. Our Selective Service Act, by which the president could then give the military permission to draft young men, passed in the Congress in late 1941 by just one vote. Our army at that time was equal to the army of Portugal. We entered World War II, 15th in military size. We had a navy, but much of it was on the bottom at Pearl Harbor. Thankfully, they didn't get the carriers, they didn't get the sub base, and they didn't get the oil. And you can study all about that. History should teach you not to repeat the same mistakes. But our government, with its globalism, with its It Takes a Village, with the One World Village concept, with the New Age idea of all lovey-dovey cooperation. Let's show everybody how loving we are. Let's show them how generous we are. Let's show them how good-spirited we are. They are absolutely hamstringing the military to the point today where not only have the barriers been lowered down to the grassroots level of allowing people to get into the military who can't write, can't read, can't spell, don't even know the language, but also the people who made careers out of the military are bailing out of there as fast as they can. They're losing the really sharp people, the pilots and the engineers and the scientists are not going into the military. They can't make it there because they're not paid enough. Their benefits are not enough. The United States military has been shrinking. We've been closing and selling bases. We've been leasing bases to foreign enemies. We have German squadrons of tornadoes flying over the desert areas of the southwest out of airports right down there in New Mexico and Texas. We've got Chinese using U.S. naval bases. And the United States is not prepared. We couldn't begin, this is a fact, to mount another desert storm if we tried today. We don't have the men and the materiel. We don't have the equipment. We don't have the ships. We don't have the aircraft. We're looking at spending, I forget what it is now, it is something like $22 billion. I forget the statistics. I'll have to go and be sure to report on them in the next issue of 21st Century Watch on the development of the F-22, which is a modern version of the F-18 Hornet, which is to be the new fighter for the American Air Force for the next maybe decade or two. And I think it is something like up to $1.5 or $2 billion per copy that we're going to spend on those aircraft. Just an astronomical sum of money. I think we are ordering the sum total, seems to me, of 6 new F-16s for the Air Force this year. 6 new fighter bombers this year. Coming to what is happening in London and tell you a little bit about Ephraim. You can be turning to the book of Hosea while I'm telling a little bit about this, because there's an interesting scripture there in the 7th chapter. London is a city today of 307 languages. From the first time I ever went to London, I was absolutely shocked by the incredible number of foreigners on the streets. They were of every shade, every color. They were from every country around the world. Remember that the British Empire once bragged that the sun never sets on the British Empire. And of course, wherever the British East India Company went, or wherever British colonists went, and that included the East African Highlands, that included the Anglo-Egyptian Sudan, all of India, all of what is today Pakistan, and all of the other countries like the Andaman and Nicobars and Ceylon. It included British Guiana. It included countries all over the world. And so listen to this. On the streets and in the schools of London right now, the languages spoken after English are as follows in their descending order: Bengali, Sylheti, Punjabi, Gujarati, Hindi, Urdu, Turkish, Arabic, Creole, Yoruba, Somali, Cantonese. And that's just the beginning, because there are 307 of them being spoken. The other day I had to hang up on a lady. I was trying to make a TV order. And she was reading some things and trying to sell me some things I didn't want. I just wanted to buy one thing. She's trying to sell me 5 or 6 other things, I think. But I said to her, "Ma'am, I'm sorry. I cannot understand you. Would you please slow down and speak clearly?" And she mumbled and she rattled on. She said some more things. I said, "I'm awfully sorry, but I cannot understand a word you're saying. Could you pronounce your consonants a little more clearly, please?" And she rattled on. I said, "I'm sorry, ma'am. Just send me what I ordered first." Click. I couldn't communicate. And she was a telephone answering service for a major telecommunications marketing firm where I was answering an ad that I saw on television. And she couldn't speak the English language. Now, I'm going to turn to this and read it because it is indicative. Hosea 7, verse 8. Ephraim. I know, I don't care what other people think, I know that that means England. So to me, it is very significant. Ephraim, he has mixed himself among the people. Ephraim is a cake not turned. Now, any housewife knows when you don't turn a cake that it just sags in the middle and it doesn't work right and that, you know, it doesn't, is not fit to eat. Strangers have devoured his strength and he knoweth it not. Yea, gray hairs are here and there upon him, yet he knoweth it not. And the pride of Israel testifies to his face, and they do not return to the Eternal their God, nor seek him for all this. Ephraim also is like a silly dove without heart. And if you think that isn't true, then I challenge you to tune in to C-SPAN and to watch the House of Commons in action. And look at the sarcasm, and look at the little quips, and look at the posturing, and look at the preening, and look at all of the arguments. And it is absolutely chaos. It's a wonder that they have any control at all. There's a madam chairman up there, but she only partially controls what is going on. You would hate to have the task of being a prime minister of the British government. It must be the most onerous job in the world. Ephraim also is like a silly dove without heart. They call to Egypt. Why do you suppose a government of England, I believe is one of the lost 10 tribes of Israel, would be dealing with nations in the Middle East? Well, why does the United States deal with Saudi Arabia? Well, because we get a tremendous percentage of our oil from beneath Saudi Arabian sands is why. They go to Assyria, and Assyria is modern-day Germany. When they shall go, while that's happening, while they are forming these alliances, while they are leaning on and depending upon these other foreign countries instead of God, I will bring them down as the fowls of the heaven, just like somebody being shot out of the sky on a quail hunt. I will chastise them as their congregation hath heard, and they have heard it. I wonder sometimes just how much of a witness you need. We'll come to that in due course if I have time here. I better hurry. Did you see the State of the Union address? I tried to watch some of it. I might have made it through about half. But I finally was so disgusted I had to turn it off because he was about to promise me a new tricycle and I couldn't handle that. Hundreds of promises. Give, give, give. Everybody's going to be satisfied. You can have everything. If you're hard of hearing, the government's going to give you a hearing aid. You need glasses, the government will provide glasses. You need a shop, the government will give you health care. Cradle to the grave, we care for you. $1 trillion+ he outlined in expenditure to print money in which we think we have confidence, which is worth nothing except the confidence in which people, you know, which they have for that money printed by our government that is absolutely bankrupt. But the man stood there and made one promise after another. And he is a man, along with his wife, who believe in globalism. One global community. An absolute disappearance of all national sovereignty, of national color, national race, national culture, national tradition, national history, national language. They want us to be one global village. And they're saying so over and over again. In Proverbs 30, verse 11 to 16, I want to read quickly. There is a generation that curses their father and does not bless their mother. There is a generation that are pure in their own eyes, yet is not washed from their filthiness. There is a generation, oh, how lofty are their eyes, and their eyelids are lifted up. There's a generation whose teeth are as swords and their jaw teeth as knives to devour the poor from off the earth and the needy from among men. The horse leech, that is a big, fat, white grub that begins to form under the hide of a horse or a cow that is laid there by a horsefly. And he penetrates, or she does, with her proboscis or whatever end that she uses, the horse hide, and puts some eggs in there. And great big old fat grubs. I used to watch my uncle take his thumbs to a cow, and you see this lump, and he would pop it, and a great fat wiggly grub would come out from beneath the hide of the cow. That's a horse leech, or a cow leech. Has two daughters crying, give, give. That's a pretty good description of America on welfare. Millions of Americans believe the government owes them a living. The government owes them a job. The government owes them a place to live. The government owes them a free education. The government owes them free health care. The government needs to take care of them. They don't need to work. They don't need to think for themselves. The government will think for them. They don't need to take any kind of, credit for a good day's work and an honest day's wage. Just let the government take care of them. And that is what is pandered to on the part of these politicians who do it for one purpose only, and that is to maintain themselves in all the power and the perquisites of that office and that power for as long as they possibly can. Which is why many people, seeing Clinton and his desires, really suspected before Y2K came on that perhaps he would find some excuse to call out the National Guard and declare a national emergency and put us under martial law and absolve the Congress. There were people who believed he would try that. I didn't believe he would because I didn't think he'd get away with it. But I'm not going to tell you that the thought didn't cross his mind. I can't read his mind. I just know an awful lot of signs and symbols there that tell you that the man has an ego that knows no bounds. So there are three things that are never satisfied, yea, four things say not, it is enough: the grave, the barren womb, the earth that is not filled with water, and the fire that saith not, it is enough. All right, I want to go over this real quickly about global government. Did you know there is coming in September of this year, sponsored by the United Nations, a meeting sponsoring global government? It is designed to examine the future of the world and, quote, create an organizational structure whereby the peoples of the world can participate effectively in global decision-making in the context of the United Nations system. In preparation for this unprecedented conference, Charter 99, a charter for global democracy, as it's called, it calls upon all nations to adopt principles of international accountability. So we are accountable to, say, Italy. And we're accountable in the United States to Portugal. And we're accounted to Cape Verde Islands. And we're accounted to any nation you want to talk about. Justice and sustainable development under the umbrella of democratic representation, through the United Nations. Called the Millennium Assembly and Summit, the meeting is a part of the UN's latest initiative to implement global government. The UN Assembly sponsor said this, and this is chilling when you think about it. Now, I'm going to really tweak the curiosity of the conspiracy theorists with this, and I know it, but I'm going to do it anyway because it is documented. Proclaiming that, quote, in many ways we now have a world government, end quote, the UN Assembly sponsor said that government, quote, is not to be found at the United Nations. Rather, they said, the UN has been sidelined while the real business of world government is conducted elsewhere. Global policies are discussed and decided behind closed doors by exclusive groups such as the G8, the OECD, Economic Council for Development, Global Development, the Bank of International Settlements, the World Bank, the IMF, International Monetary Fund, the World Trade Organization, WTO, against which I wrote some powerful articles when they were trying to form it, and others. That happens to be a fact. If you wonder who really are the movers and the shakers and who really is calling the tune behind the scenes, you just heard about those organizations, because that's where it all takes place. And for the UN to admit that is fascinating. These organizations are reinforced by informal networks of high officials and powerful alliances. Oh, if you could just be the little bird in the corner to listen in on the telephone calls between heads of state and between the world's great bankers and the heads of central banks and the heads of like G8 and global trade, if you really knew what was behind Ron Brown's mission down there when he got himself killed in an airline crash, if you really knew what was behind our first visit to China and that the entourage that went were all businessmen and what that was all about, why we must engage China even after Tiananmen Square and crushed students, bloody rags beneath the treads of tanks, a repressive totalitarian dictatorship with which we do business. Oh yeah, if you could hear some of that. Together they have created what can be seen as dominant and exclusive institutions of world government. Shocking words stated by the organization in the UN General Assembly that is sponsoring this meeting coming this fall. All too often, they are influenced by transnational corporations which pursue their own world strategies. Have you noticed all of the mergers lately? Have you noticed that even Daimler-Benz and Chrysler have gotten together? That major German and American automobile manufacturers are now one. Who are these leaders? Who are the people that call the shots? Who are the CEOs of these organizations? They are the people who are in constant communication with each other and with others of like interests. I won't read a lot of that, but at the end of it says this: Charter 99 supporters have listed 12 areas for urgent action, which includes giving the UN General Assembly more powers to scrutinize various United Nations agencies, strengthening justice, quote, under international law, end quote, giving the UN, quote, an additional and independent source of revenue, and the creation of a new, directly recruited UN Rapid Reaction Military Force. A multinational rapid reaction military force. That, I think, is knee-jerk reaction to the move on the WEU, Western European Union, which was so bitterly indicted by Margaret Thatcher, of trying to create their own rapid reaction force outside the confines of NATO. So you've got various national armies, then you've got NATO, and then you've got various pacts between and among other nations, Russia and China now saying they'll mutually come to the aid of each other if necessary. But you've also got the Western European Union Army, which may eventually become a United States of Europe Army. Now you've got the UN saying we're going to have a one global government meeting coming in September, and it will also include how to set up a rapid reaction military force under the aegis of the UN. By the way, about globalism, page after page after page of major organizations, every one of them with its own website, with its own infrastructure, with its own organization, with its own funding, and with its membership. Let me give you just a few of them you didn't know existed. The Action Coalition for Global Change. Every one of these are organizations which are one world, one global community oriented. Alliance for a Responsible and United World. Association of World Citizens. Campaign for UN Reform. Earth Action. Earth Charter. Earth Council, all different. Eden Foundation, what does that convey? EnviroLink, environmental law. Feminism and nonviolent studies. Global Education Motivators. Global Ideas Bank. Green Cross International. Hague Appeal for Peace. Mother Earth Abolition 2000. Home Planet, International Association for Educators for World Peace. International Congress for Conflict Resolution through Culture. Interdisciplinary Conference on the Environment. International Peace Bureau. International Fellowship of Reconciliation. Millennial Conference. Millennium People's Assembly. Millennium Project. New Civilization Network. Starlife Friends. Starlife Friends. They believe there are people out there. Soka Gakkai International Buddhist Lay Organization. That's the new nationalistic version of Buddhism from Japan that I've talked about in the past. Third World Network. Transnational Foundation for Peace and Research. Unified Peace Foundation. Union of International Associations. United Religions Initiative. United Peace Foundation. We the People Initiative. Women's Environment and Development Organization, World Citizen Foundation, World Federalist Association, World Federalist Movement, a different unit, World Federalist Union of Germany, World Federation of United Nations Associations, Young European Federalists, and on and on and on. Now, did you know any of those existed? And every one of those are organizations working for globalism and one world government. Well, here we are, Russia and China in lockstep, China threatening Taiwan and a war against the United States, Russia forging ties with North Korea, virtual war in the Middle East and threats from Syria, a breakdown in the peace process, so-called, Pakistan and India, like two mastiffs over a bone, threatening one another with chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons. rumblings out of Iran that they are working on a nuclear bomb, knowledge that had been revealed recently because we know UNESCO could not do its job, that both chemical and biological weapons have been stockpiled in Iraq, that in the Middle East, the IDF has been bombing Lebanon and 30,000 Israeli citizens are in underground shelters, that Syria and Jordan claim the Holocaust was greatly exaggerated, and again, North Ireland peace is being threatened. Now, I could read a lot of scriptures. I'll read just a couple. Luke 21:28. When these things begin to come to pass, and he had recited all the wars and rumors of wars, droughts and famines, all the events around the world that he said you need to watch for, when they begin to come to pass, not after they have come to fruition, not after they have passed, then look up and lift up your heads, for your redemption draweth nigh. Even though what Christ said to his disciples was frightening, remember that he said, fear not, for not an hair of your head will perish. He said, fear not, if they arrest you and take you, do not plan in advance of what you're to say, because your Heavenly Father will give you and the Holy Spirit will give you what you should say. Matthew 24:32-39, learn the parable of the fig tree. When his branch is yet tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near. So likewise you, when you shall see all these things, know that it's at the door, it is near even at the doors. Well, I can't help it. I look at world news on the internet, but I also have a lot of people who feed me an enormous amount of information. I will go to other countries all around the world, which I can do on the internet. I can look right now when I get home if I want to and see what the leading papers in Afghanistan are saying. I can find out in little nations that people don't even know exist what is going on there. And I will do that and just spend hours, you'll about need a pair of computer glasses, in going over all of these things. And just like the young lady who provided me with some of this information that she sent along, especially about the Vatican, and I want to get that in before I quit. There are an awful lot of difficulties with regard to the Pope's visit coming up this year to Israel. The chief rabbi over there has first of all said he must not come on the Sabbath, and has secondly said unless he comes into our offices, then we're not even going to meet him. And there are an awful lot of demonstrations that are set up because of the Vatican history, especially under Pope Pius XII, of cooperating with Hitler during World War II. Because Ciano, who became Pope Pius XII, spent 13 years in Germany. He was elected a cardinal just after he left Germany, became a part of the Vatican Foreign Office, and became Pope and chose the same title as his predecessor, Pius XI. But he looked the other way when hundreds upon hundreds of thousands of Hungarian, of Austrian, of Northern Italian, and even of Roman Jews were deported to Germany and to Poland. And that is documented, by the way, and there are books on that subject that I have read. So the Vatican is not revered in Israel, as one might expect. And of course, even though there is now a Vatican representative, because the Vatican, remember, is a state, and so there is a foreign minister from Israel in the Vatican and vice versa, the Pope is going to go to Jerusalem sometime later on this year, and who knows what that is going to bring about. It makes me wonder when I look at Isaiah 59, and I won't turn to that and read it, the way of peace they know not. And I ask myself, why don't they know? Well, it is exactly what Christ said about the days of Noah. They knew not until the flood came and took them all away. And I'm thinking, why didn't they know? Noah was up there shaking his fist and saying, in only 40 days now it's going to rain, and had been saying it for 120 years. So they didn't know because they chose not to know. Because they didn't want to know. They didn't want to hear it. They probably accused old Noah of nothing but headline news. And of course, Noah never had a single convert. We know that. So Jesus Christ said, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the days of the coming of Son of Man. It is going to come upon them suddenly, and of that day knoweth no man, no, not even the Son, but the Father only. So don't think we know exactly how long it's going to be or how short it's going to be before some of these events coalesce into some events that we wish we would not see happen. Well, our children, our grandchildren, our families are deeply involved. I shudder to think about a war with China or a war with any other part of the world or any other regional war and a new draft being imposed upon young American men when I've got a grandson who was 12. In 5 years, he'll be 17. So we think of those things because I live in a real world. When I was talking a while ago, the sirens were going off out the window. That's the real world. It's not a fantasy world. It's not a fake world. It's not a religion world. It's not a world of churchianity. It's a world of evil men plotting evil things and affecting the lives of millions. I'm going to conclude by passing on to you something that I really do admire, and it was written by a minister, Joe Wright, who was asked to open the new session of the Kansas Senate. When he began in this prayer, because everyone was expecting the usual generalities and a kind of a political prayer which would be read, everybody dutifully looked or got nervous or looked down, and one or two may have closed their eyes. But instead of a dutiful little political prayer, he began giving a very stirring, passionate indictment, calling upon the nation to righteousness and repentance. And as he progressed, some of the legislators got up and walked out. And here's what Joe Wright said to conclude with what I've given you here today. Oh, by the way, Paul Harvey was so impressed that he read it on his rest of the story, and he had more responses to that single program than any other program in his entire career. Interesting. This is what Joe Wright stood up and read before the Kansas legislature as late as October 1999. Heavenly Father, we come before you today to ask your forgiveness and to seek your direction and guidance. We know your word says, woe to those that call evil good, but that's exactly what we have done. We have lost our spiritual equilibrium and reversed our values. We confess that. We have ridiculed the absolute truth of your word and called it pluralism. We have worshiped other gods and called it multiculturalism. We have endorsed perversion and called it an alternative lifestyle. We've exploited the poor and called it the lottery. We have neglected the needy and called it self-preservation. We've rewarded laziness and called it welfare. We've killed our unborn children and called it a choice. We've shot abortionists and called it justifiable. We have neglected to discipline our children and called it building self-esteem. We've abused power and called it political savvy. We have coveted our neighbor's possessions and called it ambition. We have polluted the air with profanity and pornography and called it freedom of self-expression. We have ridiculed the time-honored values of our forefathers and called it enlightenment. Search us, O God, and know our hearts today. Cleanse us from every sin and set us free. Guide and bless these men and women who have been sent to direct us to the center of your will. I ask it in the name of your Son, the living Savior, Jesus Christ. Amen. It's a wonder they didn't arrest the man. I remember reading that to you one time before, but it's been sent to me for the second or third time by people who have read it on the internet and were so impressed that they sent it again. And I thought, as I go over some of these things with you today, that that would be a fitting place to conclude. I wish that prayer could be uttered sincerely from the White House.